Bob, actually, this is your fourth year coming to Hong Kong, isn't it? Bob has been coming to Hong Kong as a visiting professor, a visiting instructor in our Master of Science in e-commerce and internet. He is an expert in internet security. He is, in fact, the security officer, computer security officer of the Stanford Media Accelerator Center, the SLAC, Stanford SLAC, which is very famous. And Bob is a practitioner. It is very easy, probably, the world going around the world, to find people who actually can give academic lectures on cryptography and internet security. But those who are professors in university very frequently actually do not get their hands on the system. But Bob, indeed, is the person with a lot of practical experience. He also served as consultant to, for example, University of Cornell University, PeopleSoft, Princeton University, just to name a few. And today he is going to share with us a topic called credential repositories in an enterprise environment. I have not heard this talk before, and I was looking forward to it. Let's welcome Bob.
Thank you. Since of course there is the volume a little, okay, I'm getting some feedback. Since of course we do have an opportunity, since we're talking about computer security, to make, I couldn't resist putting a couple of graphs in here from the talk a little bit about the internet worm that has just been circulating. This is a graph of the packet loss, and I took the liberty of putting in here Hong Kong local time, so that you can see that at 1:30 on Saturday, basically, the packet loss went from typically nominally it's around 1 or 2% up to 20%, 10 times as much. Okay, particularly affected with this line, which is global web. Okay, so these graphs are available if you go to http://average.matrix.net. Okay, and in fact, right now, they will have just updated by, another 3 hours. Now, this shows sort of how basically things were brought under control over the weekend. Now, what happened this morning? What happened this morning? Well, Asia came to work, right? What did they do? They came in and they turned on their computers. And they started up new copies of MS SQL servers that hadn't been infected yet because they hadn't read their email. Well, here you can see this is when Australia went to work. Here we have Japan, Korea, China, and it looks like India is getting some technology here. There's a nice little spike when India came to work. And if I could look at the graph now, okay, we'd see Europe on here. Okay, I'm really anxious to see what happens when it hits the east coast of the U.S. And basically, you can figure in a few more hours, in about six more hours, things will have a potential of really falling apart again on the internet as the packet loss goes up. So anyway, that's just a little bit about that. Microsoft, by the way, has reissued the patch and made it easier for everybody to apply for whatever that means. The patch has been available for 6 months. It turns out, though, that the software is embedded in lots of programs that people don't even know they're running this thing. Okay? Grid computing is what this talk is supposed to be about. There's this concept that's been sort of floating around in academic and research circles for a few years now. Here it's starting to get into the mainframe. This is grid computing in your company's future. During the last 10 years, academics and startups have been connecting numerous servers to create collective supercomputers capable of performing taxing calculations such as global climate modeling. And, you know, they're also doing things like, you know, you can go to SETI at home and download this little application and start, you know, trying to find aliens sending us signals. You know, and they've been able to capture enormous capability, enormous computational capabilities from just people running this stuff on their computers at home. IBM, Microsoft, Sun Microsystems, this, and others jumped this week on the bandwagon with plans to bring the concept toward mainstream business world. Despite their endorsements, they may find it hard to convince corporate buyers to invest in technology that is allowing outsiders to access their servers. Well, it turns out, though, that it's not necessary that it's somebody from the outside is accessing your servers. Once you start thinking about the number of cycles that are not being used, that presumably if you're here to listen to this talk, you probably have one or more computers that are sitting around doing nothing right now. Think of that from a corporate world where you have hundreds if not thousands of desktop computers and other machines sitting around that for a large part of their time are doing nothing, and yet you're going out and expanding, continually expanding your computing capacity because you don't have enough. Well, what if you could harness what you already have? That's what we're talking about here and why I said enterprise with an I instead of an E. The fact that this is provides a way that a lot of companies are seeing where they can harness the computing power that exists right within the company. It's grid computing. The idea is you don't care where the cycles come from. It's location-independent access to computing resources, just like the electrical grid. Just like plugging in, you don't care where the electricity gets generated. You're just using it. You don't care where the computing cycles come from. You just want the answer back, right? So a user authenticates using some PKI, public key-based application. You request some task to be performed, and there's some sort of super scheduler that figures out, okay, where's the best place for that to happen, based upon where we have the computational resources and where we have the data located. The data and computational resources are brought together, computation's done, results are stored or either shipped back to you, however, you know, you specify. So that's basically the idea. You know, of course, you know, the devil is in the details here. Now, there is a security infrastructure here that's based on X.509 certificates, based on public key infrastructure, and there are international efforts to coordinate by several working groups within the Global Grid Forum to come up with standards for how all this is supposed to work. So what's the problem? Well, we've got to provide some sort of trusted authentication and authorization checking that goes across security and trust domains. This is the sort of the general case. This is a little bit simpler if you're all sort of like one company in one location. But it gets a lot more complex even as the company gets, you know, different offices spread around because they'll start to have different policies about how things work. The risk model is difficult to determine. What are the threats and what are the vulnerabilities? In the world of high energy physics, where we're actually going across, we have experiments that use multitudes of sites, and everybody has their own policy. But what we've got, I mean, for instance, at the Lunar Accelerator Center, we have a machine room with several thousand machines that are doing analysis of particle tracks to figure out what event just happened. Right? It turns out that is a computation that is very much like cracking passwords. Okay, so think about the use of a grid for high energy physics and think about what a wonderful tool that same thing would be to use to crack passwords or to do cracking of some other encrypted text. Okay, I mean, it's basically the same kind of work that has to go on there. So there are those kinds of threats. We need to protect but not interfere too much. We have to always balance over protection with under protection and make sure that something interesting happens. You know, I always like to think of it as being on the edge of chaos. If you think about chaotic systems, if you control them too much, then sort of it gets really boring because nothing happens. And if you don't control them enough, then it's just chaos, and that's sort of not very interesting too. But right on the boundary, there's an interesting section was an interesting place, and that's where you have to balance things. That's where all the interesting stuff happens. So that's the security problem there, is how to balance all those things out. Now, how do you log on to the grid? Well, you do this thing called the enter command. This is, you know, these are Unix-based people, right? So you enter a command at like grid proxy init, and it prompts you for a password, and you enter something that looks like a password, except now it's called a passphrase, not a password. And this creates a temporary short-lived proxy credential. This allows you, so you log in once now, and then you don't have to enter your password anymore. All you have to do is present this credential that you have now obtained. Okay, these proxy credentials are short-lived, and they're created by the user. They bind your identity with some alternative set of public and private keys. So it's not your original long-term public and private keys that are being used here. This is another set, another pair. These are stored unencrypted, so there's no passphrase associated with them because they're going to go off and be used lots of other places. Well, because they're stored unencrypted, you want them to have a short lifetime in case somebody steals them. But it enables you to authenticate once, and then these credentials can be used to perform multiple actions, like submit multiple jobs to a batch system or do a file transfer somewhere. Now, there's also a concept called delegation, which says, I'm not creating credentials on my machine, and instead, I send a request to a server, and the server is now going to get it. I'm going to delegate to the server. What happens there is that the server generates a new key pair, a new public and private key. It then creates a certificate, and it uses SSL to send me that new certificate, and I sign it with my private key and send it back. Now, notice nobody's private key has ever crossed the network. So the server now has a certificate that is signed by my proxy certificate, and my proxy certificate was signed by my long-term private key, and the associated certificate there was signed by a trusted certificate authority. So there's a chain that goes back to a trusted certificate authority that you can follow and verify that, okay, yeah, this is probably the right person. Now, there's a key step here where I went from my trusted, I went from my certificate, created a new certificate then that was signed by my certificate. Now, I'm not a certificate authority. I'm not authorized to sign and create other certificates. But it turns out this proxy certificate can be treated as a special case because it names the same person. If I was trying to sign a certificate for someone else, then it shouldn't work. But if I'm signing and creating a proxy certificate for me, then that ought to be okay. So that's sort of the idea behind this about why it is supposed to work. Now, problems with private keys, they are called users. Users, they're just now learning how, and slowly learning how to deal with passwords. And now what we're going to do is give them a private key and tell them they have to keep it. They have to keep it secret. They have to keep it safe. They have to not lose it. They have to not, they should only have it one place, but oh, by the way, if your laptop gets stolen or, the hard drive goes haywire, then you've lost your private key. That's too bad. There's no guarantee that the user will select any password, let alone a good password, because we don't have, the software doesn't force the selection of a good password. There's no guarantee that the private key is stored in a secure location. And we've seen this again and again, that in fact that some people have actually done an audit of like Android file system to see where people were storing their private key. And this audit was performed across the internet because the AFS allows, basically worldwide access to it. And there was some fairly significant percentage of the users who had stored their private key in a world-readable directory, in a world-readable file. Okay, so there's a big lack of understanding on the part of the users about how to protect private keys, particularly in network-based file systems. There's no guarantee about how private key is handled. You know, that people don't understand about, public machines and kiosks and things like that, and about how they need to clear the cache of the web browser when they leave and all sorts of things. Basically, the bottom line here is that there's a strong feeling that user-managed private keys cannot be trusted. I mean, when I say there's a strong feeling, what I'm talking about here is that as I talk to other computer security officers who are at real sites and say, how do you feel about users having the private keys? It's sort of like, oh my God, no, we can't have that. Sort of like everybody sees that users having their own private keys will end up significantly decreasing security compared with having to deal with passwords. So the rule of thumb is, if you never give the user the private key, then they can mishandle it. And that provides a stronger security guarantee. You try to have a certificate that is as secure as your normal accounts that are protected by passwords, and you provide some sort of agent-based key handling. Now, the private key we're talking about under this circumstance is used for authentication. It's not used for encryption, it's not used for signing. Or certainly it's not used for encryption of long-term documents. It may be used for encryption of data in transit, but just while it's in transit. It's not used for static document encryption. Now, let's look at an example of a repository, a secure repository for credentials. There's an IETF request for comment standard, 3157, called SACRED. SACRED is concerned with the secure credentials of in roaming mobile environment with desktop, laptop, phone, PDA. It's sort of like what we've been talking about. Their major thrust with the SACRED protocol was access from multiple places. Because the idea behind a public key is, you have to have it in one place, you keep it in one place. And what they were seeing is that people access information from all sorts of different sources, from all sorts of different desktop machines, from public kiosks, from laptops, from cell phones, from PDAs. If they're going to access information from all those sources, then they need access to their keys, their private key from all those sources. Well, how do they do that? Well, the obvious thing is to say, you access it somehow across the network, either that it's stored centrally, or if you have an always-on machine at home or something like that, then you can access, you can go back and access that machine if you're using the right protocol. So there are a number of drafts available. I assume we're going to make the talks available online so that you'd be able to just sort of click on those links. Anyway, there's lots of information about it. So the motivation, support mobility, allow the same credentials to be used from different network appliances, and to secure the credentials by storing them on a secure server. So the principles are that it must not be sent in clear text. The credentials are never sent in clear text, and not stored in clear text at either end. The secured credentials are opaque. In other words, we don't know what they are from the point of view of the credential server. It could be a Kerberos ticket, it could be a private key, it could be any number of things, but we don't know what it is. As far as this standard is concerned, it's just kind of like a blob that you move around, an encrypted blob that you move around. Clients should be able to recover credentials from the opaque object. That's their business. That's at a lower level, a different level in the protocol than what we're dealing with. The credential format should provide for integrity and protection, and the credentials must be protected by a second layer, like SSL or something like that, when they're actually going across the network. This standard supports both a credential server and direct solution. So you don't have to put your credentials in a server. If you have them stored on a machine somewhere that you have control of, you can go directly to that machine. They should use the same, those two different kinds of solutions should use the same technology, so you don't have to worry about that. The framework must allow for protocols to support different kinds of authentication, so I'm not locking you into to PKI or to Kerberos or any other particular thing like that. And the format must be opaque to the protocol, so that the protocol doesn't actually say have anything for processing. Okay, now there's some issues when using this on the grid. For instance, in traditional computing systems, they're client-server-centric. They talk about clients and servers. Grid computing is data-centric. If you think about it, traditional systems try to protect the system from the user. And what you're trying to do in a grid system is you're trying to protect the data and applications from the system, because you don't know what kind of system you're going to be running on. You don't know who owns it or who maintains it. Okay, so you need stronger mutual authentication to ensure that the resources and data are not provided by an attacker, and you have different admin domains and security policies. So there's some issues there, but that opaqueness of the credentials actually creates some problems, because we would very much more like to use it, at least at some level, define PKI, because that's what the grid currently uses. That model is changing as the grid is going to now a more web services model. But right now we're looking at that, we're having to build on PKI. Now Kerberos has another interesting way of dealing with credentials. It's another model for having a credential store. There's some extensions to Kerberos. Kerberos is defined in IRC 1510. A National Font Science Foundation has a project to support extensions for grid applications. Now, what these extensions define are a KCA, or a Kerberos Certificate Authority. Okay, this acts basically as a root certificate authority that signs a certificate for a user. So it's just like you generate your certificate and send it off to Netscape, except now you generate a certificate and send it off to the KCA to be signed. Okay, and you know, for Netscape, you have to provide some proof of identity of who you are, either like, you know, an email address that they can send something to, or you know, maybe a some sort of, you know, business card, or you know, but Netscape usually a sufficient proof of identity, I think, is a check, because that's usually what they want is money. In this case, though, for KCA, what you send it is a Kerberos ticket, where you've already authenticated yourself. Now, difficulty here is that all resource providers have to agree that they'll accept these certificates. Now, there's an interface to talk to a KCA, and that's called KX.509. This is the client side of the protocol, and what it does is it generates a key pair and sends the certificate over to the KCA, and that contains a public key, and then the KCA is going to sign it and send it back, right? The resulting credentials can be used just like the grid proxy certificate. It's just the same. Okay, now there's some drawbacks. One is that this is very site-specific. And it turns out, when you do the hacking back with the grid, you have this concept called virtual organizations, which is sort of like a project, and many times these projects span multiple sites. And so now you've got a site-specific or site-controlled form of authentication. It's not controlled by the virtual organization. And so there's kind of a dichotomy here in terms of how that's to be treated. And that is going to leave it up to the virtual organization to go around and site-by-site negotiate that these sites ought to trust the credentials that are generated by the other ones. Well, that may be tough. That may be tough to do, because there's no tradition of that. And if you have four or five sites that trust each other, and they have formed a good feeling about the credentials of each other, and now you want to add another site, that gets increasingly difficult. It's increasingly difficult. So, Anton Shevsky and I came up with this concept for a different kind of credential store that's sort of like a virtual smart card. You know, with a smart card, you also don't have access to your private key. It's stored away in the card. Right, so the idea is that, well, there's no infrastructure exists. There's no, you know, where do you go to find a smart card reader? You know, you can't walk up to a computer and use a smart card reader. But it would be nice to be able to have access to one. So suppose we have a virtual one that's stored somewhere that we can access across the internet. And so there are various ways that you can match up the different concepts that are associated with a smart card and how this is implemented in the physical smart card, and then how you implement that on the virtual smart card. Basically, what one does is you have one server that holds many users' private keys. So one server has the instantiation of many virtual smart cards. This can be well secured. You have restricted physical access, a keyed room, put it in a cage so nobody can get at it. There are only three access protocols that are needed. So basically, you can close down all of the service ports on this machine and make it very tight, very locked down, difficult to get at. It needs domain name service, it needs time, and it needs the VSC protocol. Those are the only three things it needs. Okay, the keys that are stored in this store can be encrypted by user-supplied passwords, sort of just that sort of serve as the PIN. Except it's really a password. Not, it's much better than a PIN. So now, how does it work? How does the user get a virtual smart card? Well, they send a request for certificate over to the VSC. The VSC generates the keys and then sends the certificate request up to the certificate authority. Well, you know, this is not a lot different, you know, except that now this is the user's terminal asking a server here to get the key for it. What normally happens is the user will sit here at a web browser like IE and Netscape and say, give me a certificate, and the browser generates the keys and then sends a request off to the CA, right? And now what we're doing is now instead we just send a request over here and this machine asks the CA for the certificate. But still, you know, you get in the situation where the keys are stored in Netscape or in IE, and it's about as difficult to get them out of there as it is to get them out of the, you can't get them out of the VSC. So then the CA will email a URL back to the user saying, okay, this is where you can get your certificate. Well, basically, we don't care about that, because what's going to happen is that when you try to use your certificate for the VSC, if the VSC doesn't have a certificate already, it's going to go to the CA and say, oh, do you have one for this user, and download it. And then it'll have it. It'll have an up-to-date certificate for this user. So it'll download the signed certificate. So now it's got a private key and the certificate associated with this user. So the key thing here is that the user never actually sees the private key, just like with a smart card. Now, how do you generate a proxy certificate? The one something that you can actually use as your credentials. Well, you make the first request and you get your public certificate back. This is just sort of like as a nice place for you to have your certificate stored. Sort of regardless of where you might be in the world, you can do this VSProxy command and get a copy of your public certificate. You now generate the proxy private and public key over here, just like normal, and then you send the proxy cert over and get it back. But the proxy cert will now be signed by your private key. Okay, so what you have now is indistinguishable from the, remember what we did earlier on the grid where we did that grid proxy init? We can now have a proxy credential here that is signed by your private key. You have never seen the private key, and no private key has ever crossed the network. Or is this ever magic or what? Now, how we keep things from being stolen? Well, we can use all sorts of external authentications. You've got to authenticate yourself somehow to the VSC. It can use Kerberos credentials, it can use whatever the site deems adequate, whatever the site policies are for authentication, that's what you can set up the VSC to use. That's completely flexible. It's basically, you know, whatever the site thinks is adequate. So you generate some sort of keystring from a strong user password, send an encrypted keystring over to the smart card server, use that to encrypt your private key and discard the keystring. So now your private key is not sitting over there in clear text. It's now encrypted, right? Notice that we can perform checks. The software here can perform some checks to make sure that the selected password or passphrase is actually fairly strong, that it's not easily crackable or easily guessable. Okay, now to actually then use your credentials, you have to send your keystring over there to be able to actually use the private key. So that's how we keep it from being stolen, in case someone actually broke into the VSC. Because now that's a big target, right? Now that you've collected all the users' private keys together, that could be a potentially big target, very attractive to crack into. So the users that have this additional protection, it acts like the PIN number. So the VSC advantages then are that what we have is something that's simple and effective. It models a well-known physical object. The initial certificate request is trivial. It's very easy to get a certificate in advance. The private keys are never exposed on the network, can be further encrypted by the user. We can get a proxy certificate anywhere in the world. There's no need to have multiple copies of public and private keys to use for authentication. We can provide special always-on services, perhaps by proxy certainty validation. This is a big issue because there's always the question of, well, what happens if I submit a request that, you know, it might be a week before it starts, or it might be a week before it finishes. What happens if my credentials have expired in that amount of time? Is there some way that I can have them revalidated so that I can keep on running? Well, we can potentially provide that kind of service with this virtual smart card. There's a lot of disagreement about how all that should work, so there's some standards that have to be worked out there. We can basically provide a stronger security guarantee this way because we know that the private keys have not been mishandled. The signed certificate is as secure as the institution's own accounts that are protected by their normal authentication mechanisms. Okay, there's some disadvantages. Of course, the private keys are concentrated. Yeah, and some things that are counterbalancing that are, well, they can be user encrypted. And, oh, by the way, you know, this isn't any worse than Kerberos. And Kerberos has certainly not been, so far anyway, a big target of attack. Certainly not very publicly anyway. That's a sort of a technical issue. There's a more political issue that's sort of looming here, and that is that the certificate authorities all have certificate policies and certification practice statements. And they may specify in there, and some of them do, that the user will have sole control of their private key. Well, a lot depends on what you mean by that. I mean, you could claim that in the VSC, the user has sole control, and you can say, well, that's a container just like the file system is. And then there's arguments, well, but gee, you know, all sorts of people have access to that server, but gee, you know, all sorts of people have access to lots of file systems too. I mean, you know, whoever's administrator for for the machine on which you store your private key anyway has access to it. Besides, all of the good hackers in the world also have access to it. So does it really matter? So there's the political reality where a lot of the certificate authorities are going to say, no, you can't do that. And the practical reality is that if you really look at it very hard, it seems like it doesn't matter very much. The important thing to remember is this is a key that is going to be used for authentication. It's not going to be used for signing documents. It's not going to be used for encrypting, for long-term encryption of things. Okay, and I think that is a key difference, and that would be certainly a reason that I would be willing to say, yeah, I would let this have my private key. This is no more secure. Another disadvantage is it's no more secure than the external authentication. In other words, it's no better than the password or whatever authentication mechanism that you have in use now. But the key thing is, it's not worse. It's not worse. And the fear is that if we give users their own private keys, from all the evidence we have seen so far, considering that they are only barely learning to understand how to deal with passwords, they have no way of coping with a private key at all. And we have not provided them with a secure container, a secure file system in which to put a private key. The closest thing is a smart card, and there's no infrastructure to support that. Okay, so it appears that the virtual smart cards are, relatively simple, transparent, secure. They provide a path to better security, sort of like physical smart cards. And for once, it may be that security actually will simplify people's lives if done this way, rather than make it more complicated, which it usually does. And so we are in the process now of sort of pushing the virtual smart card concept, particularly in terms of use for grid authentication. There are lots of details that have to be worked out in terms of who owns it, how many virtual smart card servers are there. Are there one per virtual organization, or is there one per site? If there's one per site, then how do they talk to each other? Issues like that. But all those appear to be easily resolvable, and the answer may be yes, all of those above, because it appears that the design is flexible enough to accommodate many different models like that. So are there any questions?